ships, all those drone flights.
Pardon me, do you have change for a quarter? I gotta make a phone call. Thank you. Oh, I hope this woman don't take me through no changes today, because I had a hard day today, man. You know, let me see what's happening at the address before I go home. How you doing? I hope you're fine. Did your day take you through changes and mess up your mind? I just called to say that I'm on my way.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That's Mondays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. Sandy, the age.
One thing before we go to the ship thing, I sort of wanted to just troll a little bit if the listeners. One of the things that is concerning right now is the safety of banks and whether people should be taking their money out of banks or not. And the economy generally. And so when you look at whether people will be taking money out of the banks, it all has to do with psychology. You know, are you confident or not? If you're confident, you leave the money in the bank, there's no problem with the bank.
But where do you get your confidence from?
But if people take their money out of the bank because they're not confident, now the bank has a problem. And it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy regarding confidence. Same is true with inflation. Same is true with the recession. If people are optimistic about the future economically, they buy things. We don't have a recession. If they're pessimistic, they pull in their horns, they save money, and then we're more likely to have a recession. And I'd be interested in so the Federal Reserve and other people are constantly taking polls. What do the people think? Are they optimistic or pessimistic? Are they afraid or are they not concerned about various situations? And I'd be interested in our listeners as to whether they have a view of this, understanding that their view is important. They might not think it's important, but if their view is shared by many, then it has a big impact on how we end up in our country financially.
Well, Sandy, how can you even if I feel, you know, that things are going great, because I hear people say to me sometimes, you act like there aren't positive things going on in the country. I've never said there weren't positive things going on in the country. But where do you get your thoughts on whether or not I'm optimistic or pessimistic? If I look at what I see on television and what I read in the media, well, it's hard for me to be.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you're very positive about the fact that your job is going to be there tomorrow, and the next year, and the year after that, if you feel very positive about your employment status, you will be more likely to spend dollars that extend into the future.
Yeah, but you can feel
you'll
it.
Be more likely to take on a car loan. So optimism comes from a whole variety of sources. How do the people around you, are they behaving optimistically or pessimistically?
Can you feel that way, Sandy, if you see that inflation is still there and you see that the Federal Reserve continues to raise interest rates, even if I feel positive?
Okay, well, now, if you feel that way, and if you believe that inflation's going to be there next year and the year after, but you also think your job is relatively secure, you're going to buy it today for sure. You're not going to wait to buy it, and you're going to be fueling inflation with your purchasing habit, the whole reason being that you think inflation is going to happen, and so now it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. My point is, almost everything that happens in our economy is a projection of the psychology of the people participating.
So, Sandy, if I'm economically secure,
mm-hmm.
and if it means that I may, you know, my job may not be as secure, but I'm already economically secure, and based on the things that are happening and the way the dominoes are falling, I can be a little more secure. But if I'm a person who lives paycheck to paycheck, I got to see it different than that, Sandy.
Right. And one of the things that I think is a concern for our economy is that very many people live paycheck to paycheck. And their optimism, to the extent they're feeling it, is very fragile because they're living a perilous existence that is very stressful. And the notion of missing a paycheck becomes an extremely perilous kind of a problem for them.
Well, it's real.
And we found it out in the pandemic. We solved it in the pandemic with a whole bunch of federal aid that leapt into the breach and solved the problem for lots of people. But those people needed the problem to be solved, and the government and the political system quickly realized it because of the rate at which, for instance, mortgages were going into default. You know, we had a slowdown. We have a paycheck missed. Mortgage goes into default. That's a precarious situation for the economy, which was resolved with a lot of federal aid, but it wouldn't be in the future. So, you know, I really am interested in what Tom, Dick, and Mary out there are feeling or thinking, because it turns out that what they're thinking has almost everything to do with how the economy ends up behaving.
So I got to tell you, I'm Tom, Dick, and Mary. That's who I am.
Yeah.
And so what I'm seeing, based on what I've seen in the past in my life, it puts me in a shaky situation, because I'm watching what's being said, the issues with the banking, the inflation, the interest rates, all of those things being raised, all of those things combined, and then the housing situation. None of those things say to me, "Hey, Earl, go out and buy a new car, go out and buy a new house, you know, go out and spend a lot of money, you know, be carefree."
Yeah.
Because I'm not financially secure that I can do those things, and it doesn't have some impact on me down the road.
Well, incidentally, about a year ago, the polling in the country suggested that many people felt the way you just described, optimistic. We were having a great deal more optimism that had crept into the American consumer's mind about the future, and it was being reflected in great growth patterns associated with purchasing, and inflation had then fueled that a little bit, because as things were going up in price, you wanted to hurry up and buy it, so you end up fueling it in the near term. But it's the process of solving that problem, the near-term inflation problem, that can lead to recession. So, you know, there's a psychology involved with inflation. There's also a psychology involved with recession. And, you know, I'd be interested. I just am very interested in what people think about in that regard.
You know, Sandy, it's a tough pill to swallow when we say we're optimistic about it and the Federal Reserve keeps saying, "Hey, we're not optimistic about it."
Exactly.
We're going to keep on until we feel comfortable. We're going to keep on tightening the screws.
Well, and the fact is that the people who are like fundamentally involved with making investments are watching the Federal Reserve, because they figure the Fed knows something we don't know. And if they continue tightening the screws like that, that's because they're seeing evidence that inflation is embedded in the economy, and they're going to keep having to tighten the screws and raise interest rates, and so we're gonna make our investment decisions based on that.
Which just occurred last week.
Yeah.
It would be different, Sandy, if the Federal Reserve had not raised the rates in the last week.
Well, last week, the concern was that if the Fed didn't raise it like they said they were going to, it was going to be because they were afraid that the banking situation was so fragile that it couldn't absorb an interest rate.
So that's why they only went a quarter point.
Well, that's why they did raise it. Many people think that's why they did raise it some, is so they wouldn't send a signal, a psychological signal out to the financial world that we're so worried about the banking system, and you ought to be worried too if we are.
Well, see,
that's the signal they didn't want to send. So they said, we aren't going to send a signal that the banking system is so fragile, so we're going to increase interest rates 0.25%, even though we know that it makes things a little harder for banks. But we want to send a signal that, hey, the banks are okay.
Yeah, but on the other side of it, they raised it because they still see inflation.
Yep. So
which is it, Sam?
They're between a rock and a hard spot. So, they're stamping out fires with both feet. And the fires aren't necessarily going out with either foot.
So if people like the Federal Reserve are still seeing this, how can the average person, I feel confident enough, let me go out and buy me a new Mercedes now.
Well, let me tell you, though, what the Federal Reserve, half of what they do is based on polling they take about what we think. It's that psychological, okay? So what we think is the ultimate important barometer here. And however, various people try to read the tea leaves, and the Federal Reserve, how they read the tea leaves is important because they actually do things in response to the tea leaves. They raise interest rates or lower interest rates.
So hearing you is that the Federal Reserve reads us, and here we are trying to read the Federal Reserve.
Exactly.
Okay. So, I mean, the Federal Reserve is in a better position.
But the problem, like I said, is the reason the financial markets put so much credence in what the Federal Reserve does is that they're capable of doing something that really matters. You know, what they do, like what I do personally doesn't matter unless a whole bunch of people
right.
do what I do. What the Federal Reserve does matters just because they are doing it, because they're raising interest rates or lowering interest rates. And those things have a real impact the moment they're done.
So, Sandy, you make my head hurt.
I know.
because you would think that the people who have these positions of power and even understanding, watching all of it, analyzing all of it, and that's their job, and they're the best, and they say, hey, whoa, wait a minute. We still think we got to slow this thing down. But somehow we're supposed to say, you know, the sheep, we're supposed to say, well, regardless of what they say, mm-hmm. I feel confident. Well, we can feel confident.
Well, the Fed is trying to impact our opinion. When they raise interest rates, they're trying to tell everyone,
slow down.
No, there's not going to be inflation, so don't worry about inflation because we're going to take care of it. So that's the whole reason that they do send a signal with theirs to us, Tom, Dick, and Mary. We're going to raise interest rates. Don't worry about inflation. And if you're not worried about inflation, inflation will go away. Because if you don't think there's going to be inflation, it's not going to happen.
So hold the thoughts then.
We end up talking. The problem is that none of this is as scientific as it seems to be. It's not scientific.
Okay, got to go to a break. Tom, hang on. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. So, Sandy. I'll see you when I get there. Shows always you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We're talking about, you know, the interest rates, inflation, and whether or not you are optimistic about your financial situation, you know, at this point. And Sandy is saying that clearly what people need to do is if all of us can somehow remain optimistic.
No, I'm not telling us what we should do. I'm interested in what we are doing, okay? I'm interested. Tom has called in. Yeah. I'll be interested in what he has to say about this.
Yeah, we're going to Tom. All right, Tom, go ahead.
Well, I just want to say, first off, we the people ultimately are the government, and I wish people would just wake up and realize that we are. And second, I just want to get back to what Sandy what he brought up, which I think is still brilliant, the $60,000 versus $64,000 conundrum. And I really want to know, I wish some conservatives would call up and say, when you basically are bringing in $60,000 a year and the four basic groups that you have to pay for come to $64,000, how is it that they... What is it they expect people to do? I just don't understand what it is that they expect people to do with child care, with medical care, with taxes, and with their mortgage or rent before they even get food or any of that.
So, Tom, what the answer to that is, what most people who live in poverty do, struggle to survive. That's what they're...
Which only causes more stress, which only causes more illness, which only causes more abuse in a family, which only... I mean, I kind of keep going back to the, you know, some of the fairy tales that we had when we were kids and the three little pigs and what you're building your foundation out of versus, you know, just building it out of sticks or out of, you know, whatever, where the big wolf is basically blowing everything down. I mean, it's just, it doesn't make sense to me that anything that you do should be building a strong foundation. And that strong foundation, you know, should be education, should be food, should be clothing, should be shelter, should be those things. And I, when these people say cut SNAP or cut this program or cut that program, rather than increasing the program, I just want to know from them, what do they expect the average person? I'm not even talking about the poor person because I feel so bad for that whole thing already. But the average middle-class person that's out there, what the hell are they supposed to do?
And Tom, I think you make a, you know, that's the point I've been trying to keep people focused on. And the stress that those people live under, the financial stress, turns into emotional stress. It turns into polarity in our political system. It turns into societal stress that we can see in a whole variety of ways. And this whole economic, what I've been talking about, you know, the business cycle, our business cycle could be greatly moderated, or at least the extreme swings of it could be moderated if we had the social safety net they have in Europe that involves the health care, child daycare, education prongs of this thing, because then people's income could swing some. They could absorb some ups and downs without the travesty that's involved of lost mortgage payment. You know, in the 2008 recession we had, the 2019 pandemic recession we had, which people were only saved from because of all the federal aid that immediately came down because of the disease component of it, demonstrated to us that our economy has no resilience when it comes down to missed paychecks. And that the severity of the social impact of recession in the United States is materially worse today than it was in the past because of this circumstance. So, you know, you bring up a good point, because I think it should scare politicians, and it should scare those watching our financial markets, because they should understand that when we go over the edge with a recession, all these people who are living paycheck to paycheck will slip into, for instance, foreclosed mortgages, and it'll be much more likely that we have housing crises associated with recessions, things that didn't always happen.
Sandy, I have a question for you. Okay, why does it seem that the politicians that are out there are working only for the 30% of the country? Because 70% of the people want gun safety. 70% of the people want prison reform in terms of you know, we have 100 million people with felony records in this country, and they can't even, when they get out, they can't even survive or make a life for themselves, even if they wanted to change their life.
I think almost
care for all, 70%. Why is it that our politicians are not listening to us? And what do we, the people who actually are the actual heirs to this government in the first place, what is it that we're doing wrong that we're not being able to put enough pressure? Because my thing is, when it came to like the Wisconsin uplifting or whatever years ago, that would have worked if there wasn't money in politics. I felt like it was more like the politicians were just waiting the people out, the uprising, waited the people out, and then after the whole protests are done, they just go back to the same.
Tom, we got to go to a break. We got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back. 2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams, and we had a great conversation off the air. You should hear it sometimes. Let's go to David from Mequon. Hey, good morning, David. You say what?
Hey, good morning. It's too late with what's going on. We have spent ourselves into oblivion, and, you know, I know you guys talked about the military budget earlier, but when you have the Inflation Reduction Act, which is really not reducing inflation, and then you have the American Rescue Plan, which is another couple trillion on top of another trillion, and then you have the CHIP Act, whatever, which was, I forgot how many, hundreds of billions more. When you start doing that, you devalue your currency. You can't keep throwing out trillions of dollars in additional on top of what you're paying on your normal stuff without having huge repercussions on the everyday American. And the Federal Reserve has been both the arsonist and kind of now trying to put out the fire. And what I mean by that is we artificially had low, low, low rates for quite a long time. So anybody that was a saver was getting literally nothing in their bank deposits, nothing. However, big developers and what have you, they're able, like, I'll give you an example. Zuckerberg, he got a special mortgage rate to purchase his house. I think it was like 1.5% or something ridiculous. So you have all this liquidity in the market. And it's, unfortunately, like I said, when you're spending trillions of dollars in addition to our normal budget, which is, I think, what, $5 trillion, it just literally destroys the currency, and that's what you're seeing today. Because if Tom were to come on the air right now, $100,000 barely gets you by in California, depending on where. If you're in San Francisco or Los Angeles, you're not too far from being on the street, even at $100,000. And the same thing in New York. And so...
Well, it's always been that case.
No, it's not always been that case. It is now...
New York and California.
Today...
Well, I think...
California was never... No, California used to be very affordable at one time.
Well...
It's not.
Regardless of the regional problem, I think the Wall Street Journal demonstrated a couple of weeks ago with an article that a heavy percentage of people who earn $100,000... where, regardless of where they live, are living paycheck to paycheck. And you can do the math very quickly on that. Now, a lot of that has to do somewhat with inflation, and inflation up until this last brief period of inflation was very low. And you're right, some of that was probably was fueled by Federal Reserve processes, which kept interest very low, and that helped keep inflation very low. I think globalization had as much to do with low inflation from the period of 2008 until 2020. The problem we face is that these families are in far more fragile circumstances today than they were in the past because of the circumstance of healthcare. Whether if they have a bronze, even if they have bronze coverage for their health insurance, they've got $10,000 of deductibles before they receive any insurance coverage. So they really can't afford health care if they're living paycheck to paycheck. And so we can conflate things a little bit. I do think that the deficit expenditures will become far greater problems, particularly if the dollar loses its world currency status. Those deficits, I think the worst deficits we incur are the ones that are not investments in anything that create greater productivity in the future, I'd feel good about deficits we were incurring to pay for education or paying for the improvement of society generally. I feel very poorly about deficits we incur year after year for an $850 billion defense budget and for some of the other things that are not investments of any kind.
But there were deficits that Dave talked about that were necessary based on COVID. Okay? I mean, and those dollars that were spent had to be spent.
Well, I do
to prevent what we're looking at coming
yes,
now.
I think they probably were, but I also think that the ability of Congress to do it with such rapidity and such a lack of concern is an exhibit of Washington's complete lack of fundamental economic discipline today and their inability to see past their nose in terms of, for instance, deficit expenditures. Deficits are pretty easy for our country as long as we're the world currency and as long as we can float treasury instruments as easily as we can with the rest of the world lined up to buy them. But if the rest of the world isn't lined up to buy them, it'll be a far different circumstance. And that's what Greece ran into. You know, when the only people who might want to buy your debt are your residents in your country, you've got a problem. So I come down in the middle. I agree with Dave that deficit after deficit's a bad idea. I think we ought to spend a lot more time analyzing why we go into the deficit, what the deficit expenditures are for. And we ought to, for instance, stop financing our foreign military adventures with deficits. We spent $1 trillion, you know, from the period of 2008 to 2020, well over $1 trillion on foreign military adventure.
But so when we talk like the deficit expenditures have somehow benefited the everyday American person, that's not the case. It's not the case.
Well, no. I mean, some of them did. Some of the ones that Dave just recited.
No, I'm not saying some of them didn't. But let's stop acting like the majority of those deficits are with the government trying to uplift the average American person. That's not the truth.
No, that's what's not the truth. And I think if we could get the government focused on improving educational circumstances, training circumstances, health circumstances, societal circumstances, bringing our society into a position where a greater percentage of our society was participating productively in the economy, paying taxes and contributing to the economy in positive ways, the more you could justify those deficits.
So how do you justify those deficits, Sandy, when many of those deficits are from what we're doing with the resources that we have supposedly helping our allies or it's making sure we're spending money to keep the military bases up and going, you know, 700-some-odd military
bases?
Well,
you know, the fact is that in war circumstances right up until Vietnam, our country would exercise the discipline of increasing taxes, selling war bonds, participating in a process of identifying for the public the fact that we were spending a great deal of tax dollars in a military, in a circumstance. But we stopped doing that in Vietnam. We wanted to have guns and butter, as they called it back then. And ever since then, we've had guns and butter. We've had substantial military expenditures without any recognition of those costs in our tax. In fact, we've had tax cuts. Under the Bush administration, we not only went to war and were spending money at the rate of essentially $1 trillion over a period of a war, but we also had a tax cut.
So Sandy, why push back on David and others who basically say we've gotten into this situation by giving money to people and helping people? That's when you and we talk about creating a safety net, which we still don't have.
Right.
It's not like we've been giving a whole lot of money to people for people to lift themselves up.
No.
That's not where these deficits, for the most part, have come from.
True. But there's $750 billion or $850 billion of military expenditures, which if we didn't have a deficit covering those, we'd have $850 billion less deficit. So my point is, we need to look at the revenue side of this thing, and we need to increase our taxes. And,
yes.
And Dave, I think, would agree that if we're going to be economically responsible about this, either you're going to reduce expenditures, or you're going to increase taxes, or you're going to do some combination of the two in order to get things closer to balance. And of course, the what we've had recently is a one-way ratchet with our taxes. Taxes go down. Then we have inflation. We don't talk about increasing taxes to fight it. We talk about doing other things.
Right.
I don't know if Dave is still on the line.
No, he's not. Yeah. Let's go to Tom. Tom, you still there?
Yeah, I am. Exactly, Earl, what you just said. Dave just brought up the whole thing about, you know, programs, again, that help the average person who is we the people. He didn't bring up anything about the military-industrial complex. And what I would say is we need to start looking at things that bring us, as myself, as a mom-and-pop small business owner, we need to start looking at things of what brings us a return on investment. Return on investment, when you give someone, you know, the money that we gave during the COVID thing, that came back to us in threefold.
Yeah, people spent that money.
SNAP benefits, that comes back to us in terms of return on investment. You go and blow up something, you not only take fireworks, just as an example, if you want to use that in terms of bombs. You shoot it up in the air, it explodes. No redeeming value whatsoever. All you've done is maybe pissed off another country, so therefore they're going to come back and get you at some day, whether it's through a cyber attack or whatever it might be. There is no redeeming value or no return on investment with those things. So I would say that, you know, when we talk about things and programs and things like that, whether it's college tuition for free or college education for free, which gives us a more a smarter society, when we're talking about Medicare for all, and we're talking about people can be taken away from some of these stresses of medical care or child care or what have you, those are the things that actually pay a society back. That's actually a return on investment. If you're a business person, you should be thinking that way, not about something that just goes up in the air and goes kabooey or goes over to another country and blows it up. That doesn't do anything. There is no return on investment in terms of those things, except for the military industrial complex who just gets rich.
All right, Tom, thank you very much for the call. You know, Sandy, it is the frustrations that I feel about all of these things is that, you know, where's the consciousness going to come from? That's let's go. David is back. David, quickly.
We need to stop subsidizing something called the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, it was supposed to be affordable, and because it's set up to be it's made things worse because you're essentially, you're changing the actual market based on what the government is telling what insurance should and can do or can't do. And so essentially it's a house of cards, essentially.
Well,
because
Dave,
like you said, when it was
Dave, we have essentially mandatory automobile insurance, and what killed the Affordable Care Act's capacity to make it actually affordable was when the mandate was removed from the Affordable Care Act so that everyone didn't have to be in the insurance pool. What was mandated by it was requirement that pre-existing conditions be covered, which everyone politically, both sides of the aisle, now see that that's completely a necessity. We have a break, I guess.
Hang on. Got to go to break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.
This time but I love you much better. Yeah, baby, you're in my arms again. This time I'll hold you forever. This time we'll never end. Yeah, baby, you're in my arms.
Yeah.
right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Monday's my co-host, Sandy Williams. Let's go to the phone lines. And let's go to Bill. Good morning, Bill. How you doing? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Oh, great. Earl, by the way, I saw you on TV for the prom that you were organizing. That was just wonderful, Earl.
Oh, thank you.
I love what you do, buddy.
Thank you.
I really, really do. I admire you. Someday I hope to meet you face-to-face.
Well, it won't be hard.
Okay.
All right.
Good. Any other guy, the guy that called right before the commercial about
Dave.
The Affordable Care Act, my question to him and anybody else is, give me a better program. Number one, these people who don't like that, they all know what's wrong with it, but they don't know how to fix it. And with the Affordable Care Act, the minute we can have some control over these insurance companies, we will start to turn healthcare affordable. My case in point is, if you're familiar with Mayo Clinic, how they operate compared to how the rest of the country operates, back when before health insurance, like we have today, hospitals had one floor with a few offices. Now they have a whole building with all offices processing for insurance companies for health care. When we wake up and realize where the real cost of health care is, it isn't the people, it isn't the actual cost. It's how it goes from point A to point B and point C and D on, and who takes the cut. I'll hang up, and I just want to hear your thoughts and Sandy's thoughts.
So let me say this, because one of the things, Sandy, that I was going to talk about today that we didn't get to was... people can't get New York Times. People can't get their ADHD medicine, and that's a sign of a larger problem. The fact that the cost of medications continue to go through the roof, the fact that there's a new cancer drug that has been out that was founded, Sandy, with the taxpayers' dollars, and in the United States, the people can't afford it. Prostate cancer drug, because the drugs overseas make it affordable for the people overseas, but the people in America die because they can't afford the medication, because we can't force the Joe Biden and others can't force the pharmaceutical companies to price the medication to save the lives of the American people, even though that's been was created by the taxpayers of the America. All of those things, Sandy.
Well,
make any sense.
Well, it's another case of the failure of government to exercise its regulatory powers when it should, where it should, and to the extent it should. Our banking problem is clearly the result of us backing off on bank regulation. At least that's a significant contributor to it. Our unwillingness to force to have negotiations by the government with respect to prescription drugs for
yes.
its Medicare and Medicaid is clearly another situation where K Street has exercised its muscle to cause there to be a back off by the government on things that it otherwise could be exercising its muscle to achieve. You know, we should be. Yes, we have patents for drugs, and we think that that increases the rate at which new drug discoveries are made. But we ought to have a process for regulating the price of these drugs, because when a drug has a patent, it has a monopoly. And how do you price something that is a monopoly product? And if that monopoly is a unique cure for instance, cancer, and if it's federal grants that were used for the process of developing the patent, then why in the world is the government not stepping forward and say, look, we're going to give you a reasonable profit on what you did here, but you're not going to be able to gouge your profit because you have a monopoly
well,
on this drug.
Even the president of the United States has not done what he can do to get that, bring that in order. And Sandy, those are the kind of things that, to me, should be just totally unacceptable. If in fact the taxpayers have helped create the development of the drug, then how can a company say to the taxpayer in this country. Well, your life doesn't have, it's got a value on it, but my medication that I'm, that, you know.
Here's a quick summary of the world in the United States with respect to how our government behaves. Inadequate rail regulations, rail problems. Inadequate funding of FEMA, FEMA problems when we have demonstrable crises.
Mississippi right now.
We've got the government not exercising its muscle to control drug prices. When the rest of the world gets drugs reasonably, we pay through the nose for it. We've got bank failures as the result of the back off of bank regulations. It's the list is very long, and yet here we have a debate in Congress about how we want to cut back on government expenditures. Do we want to cut back on the functions of government so they can then do a job which is more inferior than the job it's currently doing? Don't we understand? Why do we not learn that it's government that can solve these problems, but we have to fund government, we have to appreciate government, we have to recognize the value of government, and we have to make sure it's an effective government. But instead, we've had a 50-year war that is just against government generally. It's the Grover Norquist, Ronald Reagan started war against government, that Washington is your enemy, not your friend. You know, we've got to turn that around. And the reason we've gotten this to this point, I would accuse K Street, the people who are regulated, who want to get out from under the potential flexing of the government and its muscle, who have persuaded the public, or at least our legislative leaders, to back off. And it's all to our detriment.
You know, Sandy, that's the part that angers me, not just frustrates me, but angers me, that American people can die because medications that were produced through those taxpayers' dollars, they're not eligible for them. They can't afford them. But somebody in Timbuktu gets that break that you and I, as American citizens, should be entitled to.
Well, like I said, I just think the list is long of the evidence of the extent to which government has backed off from its duties and its functions. And the reason is the sort of war on government that we've had. And what the American public ought to stand up for is the fact that, and the wealthy people in this country whose golden goose is America ought to be realizing is that they don't want to kill this golden goose. They want it to work. And in order to make it work, we have to end up with a government that does regulation where it should, when it should, and to the extent it should, and it should be effective.
All right, Sandy, you got the last word. We'll see you again on Friday. Thank everybody who made the show go. Thank you, Calvin. We'll see you later.
I'm so into you. I'm so into you.